Hi, and welcome to Law for Community Workers on the Go. This is a series of podcasts brought to you by Legal Aid New South Wales. In each episode, one of us from the Community Legal Education branch will be chatting to experts on different legal topics. We're really excited to have you all listening today and hope that you'll learn something new and interesting. This is our first episode, so today you'll be hearing from Joshua Scotland and Alex Davis talking about technology-facilitated domestic violence. Now, we want this to be a safe space for our listeners, so if you need support at any time, there are services that can help you and you can find their details in the information below. So, over to you, Josh.
Hi, welcome to Legal Aid New South Wales podcast, Law for Community Workers on the Go. This is our first episode and today we will be talking about technology-facilitated domestic violence. Firstly, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording this podcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I would also like to pay respect to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to other Indigenous Australians who might be listening.
My name is Joshua Scotland. I'm in the Community Legal Education branch at Legal Aid. And I am here with...
Hi, my name's Alex Davis. So I'm a solicitor in the Domestic Violence Unit of Legal Aid.
Thanks so much, Alex, and thanks so much for joining us today. Would you be able to tell me what kind of work you're working on at the moment?
Sure. So I have an interesting hybrid job where I am a solicitor. So I work a lot in the family law system, but I also work across family violence. So any clients who are affected by family violence, I can talk to them about their legal issues. And I do a lot of duty work. So in the local courts, as well as in the family court registries, we also do some ongoing matters and telephone advice. But apart from that, the second part of my job is project work. So at the moment, I'm doing a national project, which is building a family violence resource. It's going to be a book and a website and looking at family violence, family law and care and protection.
Okay, wow. And can we unpack a little bit more that project that you're working on? So what is the end goal? What are you hoping will happen as a result of this project?
So this project is going to be a way of people accessing information about the family violence systems. It's different in each state and territory. So the idea is one central location with a lot of information, but also a lot of links to existing resources and services, and also to really promote a part of our service is the Family Advocacy and Support Service. So that's duty work that we do at the family courts. In every state and territory, there's an equivalent. So making sure that people across Australia are aware of this new service.
Mm-hmm. And when you say duty work, what does that mean?
Good question. So duty work means that when a person has a matter in court and they don't have a lawyer or they need like legal representation or just some advice, then they can come and see us. So it operates a little bit differently in each state and territory, but in New South Wales, we cover Newcastle, Wollongong, Sydney and Parramatta Family Law Court registries, and we're there each weekday. So there's lawyers working there to help people with their legal needs, but we also have social workers.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. And today we're going to be talking about domestic violence, which may be difficult for some people. What would your advice be to any community workers that are listening, that are concerned about listening further?
Sure. So we definitely will be discussing domestic violence and sexual violence today. So if anyone is personally affected or knows someone affected and needs help and assistance, I'd recommend calling 1-800-RESPECT, which is the 24/7 counselling hotline, or call 000 if you're in immediate need of immediate risk of danger.
Mm-hmm. And would we be able to kind of dive straight into a client that you've had which had an issue which involved technology? Because I know that's an area that you're really interested in, how technology can impact on domestic violence relationships.
Yeah, sure. So technology is just another tool that's being used by people who use domestic violence. So it's a tactic of control. And it's something that I see so frequently. And over my years of practicing, it's just become more and more of an issue. It's also really difficult because the laws are trying to keep up, but sometimes it's difficult to be enforced. So one example would be a client that I had recently. She was from overseas and her family still lived overseas. So she came over to Australia on a temporary partner visa, and her partner were living together. So he used a lot of violence to coerce her into taking photos of herself naked, images and videos, which she actually didn't really want to do. And then once she tried to separate from him, he threatened to send those to her children overseas and her family members. And she tried to report it to the police, and they weren't particularly concerned at first. Those images ended up being actually shared overseas. And then there were some issues because once that was reported, because the people who received those images were overseas, it was very difficult for the police to get statements, to lay charges. And so the abuse continued in other ways. And her ex-partner took over her social media accounts, changed her photos so that it was her naked, other things like that that were reported. And it got to such a terrible stage that she ended up going to the police, and she felt like she wasn't being heard or assisted. She ended up having a breakdown and then being scheduled under the Mental Health Act.
Mm.
So she was in hospital for a few days. We then engaged with her and started doing some advocacy with the police. We got her AVO varied so that it had specific orders on it that mean that the other party is not allowed to continue sharing those images. And I should say that this happened before new legislation came in, which specifically criminalizes the sharing or threatened sharing of intimate images. So this new law came into effect in August of 2017. So this incident all happened before then. And now, had this been reported to police, I think that the results would be very different, because there has been a lot of charges under this new legislation already. So we've been working and talking with some of the police prosecutors, and we're seeing it through the local courts and our duty work. So it's actually being used. But that's an example of, I suppose, why the law needed to be changed. And I think that hopefully some of our clients will get better results now, that there's specific crimes of threatening to distribute intimate images or actually sharing intimate images without consent.
Yeah, wow. And do you have any advice for community workers that are listening, that I guess it may take some time before you establish enough rapport where a client would feel comfortable enough to talk about those things with you? Do you have any advice for community workers about how they might become aware that somebody is having these kinds of experiences?
That's a really good question, because it's definitely something that a lot of people feel quite self-conscious about talking about. And it's a matter of building rapport with a client so that they trust you. I think the majority of the clients I see are women who are affected by domestic violence and sexual violence. And I think it's a lot easier sometimes for those clients to open up to female workers.
Mm-hmm.
So that story that I just told, in particular, one of the hurdles for that client was most of the police officers that she was dealing with were men, and she didn't really feel comfortable having to show those images to the police to make that report. So I think having a very open mind and being non-judgmental is incredibly important, because these images they come into being in so many different ways. So sometimes they're consensually made because it's in a happier time in a relationship. Sometimes they're made without consent. So a person might be unconscious, or there's hidden cameras. They have no idea that the images have even been made. A lot of the time in a domestic violence context, there's fear. So that might be a driving force as to how the images are made. And I've even had clients where the images have been doctored. So it's their head on someone else's body, but the joys of Photoshop these days mean that it can be incredibly convincing. So there's lots of different ways that these images are made. And I think when we approach clients, having a really open mind and being non-judgmental. Mm-hmm. And I think if people are aware that this is actually so prevalent. So there was research done by some excellent academics. So Anastasia Powell, Nicola Henry, and Asha Flynn. Basically, they did a massive study in 2017, and they found that 1 in 5 Australians have actually been a victim of image-based abuse.
Mm.
So keeping that in mind, knowing how prevalent it is and asking the right sort of screening questions, I think can really help a client to open up about it. Also showing that we're not judging and that we actually care and want to help them to rectify the situation or to ensure that the images aren't further distributed.
And do you think there's a role for community workers to be advocates for their clients to help somebody make a complaint to police in that kind of situation that you've just described? Or do you think it would be better that a community worker refers their client to our service and they can get legal advice? Or where do you think that line is?
I think that both options are really good. I think that this is a crime. People need to be reporting it to the police. Police are able to take swift action, they're able to lay charges. I think one of the difficulties with domestic violence as well is that a lot of people are scared to go to the police or worried about what repercussions there may be. And certainly in these sorts of matters where there's threats to share the images, and most commonly in my experience, one thing that really defines how this is used in domestic violence contexts is we're talking about these images usually being shared with friends and family members in a way to shame and humiliate a person. A lot of image-based abuse, and I'm using that terminology really specifically because we're trying to move away from calling this revenge porn, but a lot of...
And can I just ask why that?
Yeah, sure.
Why the move?
So the reason that we don't want to use the terminology revenge porn is because it's a bit of a misnomer and it's not always for revenge. So there's so many different reasons this might occur. It could be for revenge. It could be for money. It could be to humiliate a person. It could be for sexual gratification. So that's the first part. But also the term revenge makes it sound like someone has done something to deserve this sort of behavior, which they haven't. Mm-hmm. Also trying to say that it's pornography is to say that it's perhaps something that's been done with an intention of being sexualized, and that's not necessarily why it's been produced. And often, like I said, there's so many ways that this can even be created. So to call it revenge porn is really putting the focus on the actions of the victim when really we need to be talking about how this is a wrong by the perpetrator. So that's why I use that terminology. In terms of trying to get assistance. So going to the police, I think the role of community workers can be to help clients to make that report, especially if a person is feeling hesitant to make it, and to help perhaps with gathering some of the evidence. Because in, like I mentioned, in a lot of domestic violence contexts, it's not going to be that it's actually posted on the internet on these, in quotation marks, revenge porn websites. And at present, we know there's over 3,000 of those websites in existence.
Mm-hmm.
And so they might need support to go and make the report to police, also to gather screenshots and other things that show that this has actually happened, that there are threats there. And if a person happens to get a bad response from the duty officer, then helping them to ask to speak with the domestic violence liaison officer or a shift sergeant or a manager who might be on at the time. But I think that there has been a bit of a shift because this new legislation makes a really strong comment that this behavior is completely unacceptable. It's now criminalized, and the penalties, maximum penalties for this are quite extreme. So it's a maximum jail sentence of 3 years or 100 penalty units, and it's also an indictable offence.
And what does an indictable offence mean?
So that's a serious offence as opposed to what we call a summary offence. And the reason it's an indictable offence as well means that the powers of the police are a bit more expanded to do investigation work. So they can seize a person's phone or computer when it's an indictable offence. Mm-hmm. So it's to help with securing charges.
I've also heard you talk about surveillance technology that some perpetrators of domestic violence will use. Are there any tips that you would give to community workers where they might be able to help their clients to become aware that that technology is being used?
Yes, certainly. So it's so hard to keep up with the technology because it's constantly changing, and being aware that this does exist. So there's a lot of spyware that can be put onto phones, be put onto computers to allow unfettered access to a person's information. So contacts, who they're calling, websites they're going. There's ways of blocking numbers. So people, for example, can't call 000 or taking photos using their camera, accessing all of their information. So knowing that that is something that does exist. So if a person feels like the other party somehow has information that they've never said, because also a lot of these apps allow you to use the device as a recording device and to record conversations and calls as well. So if a person has that gut feeling, we need to listen to it. And there's a lot of great organizations that can help. Mm-hmm. And one in particular is called WESNET. So that's the Women's Services Network, WESNET. So they have a great partnership with Telstra, where they offer people who are experiencing technology-facilitated violence to get a brand new free phone if they're also victims of domestic violence or sexual violence. They have lots of partner organizations. So the Domestic Violence Unit of Legal Aid, we're one of them. Mm-hmm. So we're able to give our clients free, safe phones if they need it. We also do a lot of safety planning with our clients, and so do a range of other organizations, such as the Women's Domestic Violence Court Advocacy Service, and their number is 1-800-WDVCAS. And if you do need to get your client a free, safe phone, call WESNET on 1-800-WESNET.
And is that technology illegal in and of itself?
Yes. So it is under a whole range of legislation. So in each state and territory, there is surveillance devices legislation. In New South Wales, our legislation says that it's a crime to record a person without their consent if it's a private conversation. And there are some exceptions, such as to protect your legal interests, because a lot of the time with my family law clients, they might want to record, for example, handover when their children are going from one parent to the other because they're fearful. So if that's in a public place, then it's also not going to be so much of a problem. But private conversations can be an issue. And a lot of the time, if a person's got an AVO for their protection that says the other party is not allowed to contact them, they might also want to make recordings on their phone to show that there's been a breach of the AVO. So a lot of people are quite fearful of being charged under the surveillance devices legislation for doing things that are meant to be protecting themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's why that exception is really important, and it does exist. Now, the legislation also says that it's illegal to use a GPS tracking device on a person. Mm-hmm. And often the way that people are tracked, there's so many ways. So one example is these GPS tiles that you can get. They're really small. They connect to an app on an iPhone or an Android phone. But besides from that, most people have smartphones these days, and most of them have an inbuilt GPS system on the phone. So, for example, if you've got an Apple phone, then you'll have an Apple ID. And if you know how to log into that, then you can use that to track a person's phone. So I've had a whole heap of clients where the way that their ex-partner has found their location is not actually using the terrifying spyware apps, but by using things that are inbuilt in their phone. And often a person might get a phone, it's already set up, they don't know those account details. And so trying to basically make sure that they're not being tracked through those inbuilt systems can be difficult. So that's when we'd recommend getting a new safe phone.
Mm-hmm. And are there any steps that you would encourage community workers to take when a client comes in and they're concerned that they are being surveilled? Would you encourage them to take any steps, or would you just put them straight in contact with one of the partners? Was it
Wesnet? Yeah, so that's a really good question. What I often do with clients, if they've indicated to me that they think they're being tracked or listened to on their device or they don't think it's safe, then I will ask for their consent. And then if they give it, I'll go into their phone. I'll turn off the Wi-Fi. I'll turn off the cellular data, the location settings, and that should help to make sure that there's no internet connection, because a lot of the spyware apps and other things, they need a connection to the internet to actually work. And turning it on to airplane mode these days isn't enough, because it doesn't necessarily disable the Bluetooth and the Wi-Fi. So we need to manually do that. So once those things are turned off, the device is hopefully safe, and then I might have a look around. So there's some really great training that's offered for free from the eSafety Commissioner. So the eSafety Commissioner has just had expanded powers. It used to be the eSafety Commissioner for Children, and now it's basically just eSafety. Mm-hmm. And so they've got a whole new portal online where, for example, if you're a victim of image-based abuse and if you've tried to report to the police and it hasn't worked, or perhaps you don't want to go to the police, you can report through them. They also have really good hookups with social media platforms if things are online, can help with takedown notices. So that's a really good avenue. And they've also got this amazing new partnership with Facebook, very interesting, where they're using Facebook facial recognition technology. So if a person is worried that they've got naked photos that are somehow going to get onto Facebook or Messenger or Instagram, then they send it through to the eSafety Commissioner, who gets in contact with Facebook. Facebook uses that facial recognition technology to put a fingerprint on the image. So it, if it ever gets uploaded onto their platform, it's immediately blocked. So interesting ways that technology is being used to sort of protect people as well. So one option is going through the eSafety Commissioner, getting some further training if you feel like you're not able to keep up with all of this. But also there's a whole suite of great resources on that website for other types of technology-facilitated violence. So things about surveillance devices as well as other forms of stalking, online stalking.
Wow. Alex, thank you so much for joining us. I've learned a whole bunch and it's been really, really interesting. If a community worker does want to refer a client to our services, what's the best way for them to do that?
So I'd highly recommend getting in contact with the Domestic Violence Unit of Legal Aid if your client has these specific issues. And our number is 02-9219-6300. So give us a call if you have any clients that you need to make a warm referral for.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for tuning in today. If you're enjoying Law for Community Workers on the Go, make sure to spread the word. And if you have any feedback or even topic suggestions, please get in touch with us via email. Our address is cle@legalaid.newsouthwales.gov.au. We'd love to hear from you. So until next time, thanks again from the CLE branch here at Legal Aid New South Wales.